Imagine you are standing at the edge of two football pitches. On one side, players race and shout, each one trying to score individually, celebrating their own goals with a personal dance. On the other side, players move quietly and carefully, always passing, always sharing credit, never drawing attention to themselves. You check the rulebook. It is exactly the same for both teams. The rules did not create this difference. Something deeper did. Something invisible but very real. That something is culture. Now take this idea and apply it to entire nations. Every country has a constitution, laws, and a government. These are the official rules. But underneath those written rules sits a deeper layer of shared beliefs, values, and unwritten expectations. This invisible layer shapes how people think about power, how they treat their leaders, when they protest and when they stay silent, what they demand from government and what they are willing to give. This invisible layer is what political scientists call political culture. Today we are going to explore it carefully, using stories, examples, and comparisons to make it as clear and vivid as possible. Let us begin with the most important question of all. What exactly is political culture? The simplest definition is this. Political culture is the shared political personality of a society. It is the collection of beliefs, feelings, and unwritten rules that a group of people holds about their political world. Notice the word shared. Political culture is not just one person's opinion. It is what most people in a society broadly agree on, often without even realizing they agree, because it feels so natural to them. Just as a fish does not think about the water it swims in, most citizens do not consciously think about their political culture. They simply live inside it. The two scholars most responsible for making this idea rigorous and scientific were Gabriel Almond and Sidney Verba. In 1963, they published a book called The Civic Culture, which became one of the most important works in the study of politics. They surveyed thousands of ordinary citizens across five countries, the United States, the United Kingdom, West Germany, Italy, and Mexico. They asked people about their knowledge of government, their feelings toward their country, and their beliefs about whether they could influence political decisions. From this massive study, they built a framework for understanding political culture that scholars still use today. Almond and Verba said that political culture has three distinct parts. The first part is beliefs. Beliefs are what people think is true about the political world. Do citizens know who their elected representative is? Do they believe their government is honest or corrupt? Do they think their vote actually makes a difference? These are beliefs. A person might believe, for example, that elections in their country are fair. Or they might believe that powerful business interests control every outcome no matter who wins. These are very different beliefs, and they will lead to very different political behavior. The second part is values. Values are what people feel is important or right in the political world. They are the emotional and moral dimension of politics. For instance, some societies deeply value individual freedom. They believe the most important thing a government can do is stay out of people's lives and let them make their own choices. Other societies deeply value collective security. They believe the most important thing a government can do is protect everyone from poverty, illness, and misfortune, even if that means taking more money in taxes and limiting some individual choices. Neither of these is simply right or wrong. They are different values, and they produce very different political systems. The third part is norms. A norm is an unwritten rule about how people are expected to behave. It is not written in a law book, but almost everyone knows it and follows it. Norms are enormously powerful in politics. For example, in many established democracies there is a powerful norm that says a candidate who loses an election must publicly and gracefully accept their defeat. There is no law that forces a losing candidate to do this. But the social expectation is so strong that breaking this norm is considered a serious crisis. When a leader refuses to accept a democratic result, it shocks people precisely because it violates something they considered almost sacred, even though it was never written down. Now think about how these three parts connect. If citizens believe the election was stolen when it was not, their beliefs are wrong. If they value personal loyalty to a leader more than they value the rules of democracy, their values will override their commitment to fair play, and if the norm of peaceful transition of power is weak or new, it will not hold firm under pressure. Political culture, in all three of its parts, is what makes democracy either fragile or strong. This is why it matters so much. Almond and Verba then described three basic types of political culture that they observed across the world. Understanding these types is like having a map. Once you know the territory, you can see where each country sits and why it behaves the way it does. The first type is called parochial culture. The word parochial means narrow or limited in focus, like a parish church that only cares about its own small community. In a parochial political culture, ordinary citizens have very little awareness of or interest in the national political system. Their attention is focused entirely on their immediate world, their village, their family, their clan, their local chief. They do not expect anything from the national government, and they do not feel any connection to it. National politics is something that happens far away to other people and has nothing to do with their daily lives. This kind of culture is most common in very traditional societies where the modern nation-state has not fully reached into people's lives. A farmer in a remote village who has never heard of the national parliament and simply follows the instructions of the local elder is living inside a parochial political culture. The second type is called subject culture. In a subject culture, citizens know that the national government exists. They are aware of its power, they might feel pride in their nation, and they understand that government produces laws and rules that affect their lives. But they see themselves as subjects, meaning passive recipients of whatever the government decides. They do not see themselves as actors who can shape or change political outcomes. Think of the word subject here carefully. A subject is someone who is ruled over. A subject culture produces citizens who accept political decisions from above rather than demanding a voice in making them. This culture is typical of centralized, authoritarian states, meaning states where a small group holds all real power. A citizen who pays their taxes, obeys the laws, takes pride in their country, but never imagines that they personally could influence what the government does is living inside a subject political culture. The third type is called participant culture. In a participant culture, citizens are fully aware of the political system. They understand how it works, they believe their voices matter, and they actively engage with politics. They vote, they join political parties, they write to their representatives, they protest, they organize. They see themselves not as subjects but as citizens, meaning active members of the political community with rights and responsibilities. A participant culture is most compatible with democracy because democracy requires people who believe they have a stake in governing. Here is where Almond and Verba made their most interesting and surprising argument. You might think that the best possible political culture for a democracy would be a pure participant culture, where every citizen is fully engaged and politically active at all times. But Almond and Verba said no. A pure participant culture, they argued, can actually be unstable. If every citizen is constantly demanding, constantly challenging, constantly mobilized, the government becomes overwhelmed. It cannot make any decisions without facing a crisis of opposition. The system becomes paralyzed. Instead, they proposed an ideal blend they called the civic culture. The civic culture mixes all three types. Most citizens are willing to participate when important matters arise, but they also maintain a healthy degree of trust and deference, meaning respect for authority, in their everyday lives. They are not constantly mobilized. They also care about non-political parts of life, their families, their work, their local communities. This balance, Almond and Verba argued, creates a stable and functional democracy. Citizens are engaged enough to hold the government accountable, but not so permanently inflamed that the government cannot function. It is a delicate and precious balance, and many countries spend generations trying to achieve it. So, where does political culture come from? The answer is that it is learned. Human beings are not born knowing whether to trust or distrust government. They are not born valuing individual freedom over collective security. These orientations are absorbed slowly, over time, from the world around us. The process of learning political beliefs and values is called political socialization. Think of the word socialization as meaning the process of being taught how to be a member of society. Several powerful agents, meaning sources, carry this learning. The most powerful agent is the family. Long before a child ever enters a classroom or watches the news, they are absorbing the political attitudes of their parents. A child who grows up hearing their parents express distrust of government will likely develop the same distrust. A child who grows up in a household where voting is treated as a sacred duty will likely grow up to be a voter. The family does not usually teach political values consciously. It is absorbed through dinner table conversations, casual comments, and the emotional atmosphere of home. Research consistently shows that family political orientations, including which party parents support, are transmitted to children with remarkable reliability. Schools are the second great agent of political socialization. Schools teach national history and civic values, meaning the values that hold a political community together. They teach children to recite pledges of allegiance, to sing national anthems, to respect national symbols. They tell stories of founding heroes and national struggles. This is not simply education. It is a deliberate building of political identity. When Japanese children learn about the suffering of World War II, when American children learn about the Declaration of Independence, when French children learn about the Revolution, they are being shaped into citizens with a specific relationship to their nation's political story. Different national stories produce different national identities, and different national identities produce different political cultures. The media, meaning newspapers, television, radio, and now social media and the internet, is the primary source of political information for most adults. What the media chooses to cover, and how it chooses to frame those stories, powerfully shapes what people believe is happening in their political world. A media that portrays politicians as universally corrupt will breed cynicism. A media that explains policy debates carefully and fairly will breed informed participation. A media that amplifies fear and division will breed hostility. The media does not just reflect political culture. It actively creates and reshapes it, which is why the relationship between politics and media is one of the most important and contested areas in modern political science. Peer groups, meaning friends, colleagues, and communities, also shape political values. If you join a trade union, meaning a workers' organization that negotiates for better wages and conditions, you will likely be exposed to values about economic fairness and collective action that reinforce a particular political outlook. If you join an evangelical church, you may be exposed to values about family, tradition, and religious authority that reinforce a different outlook. People tend to cluster with others who share their values, which reinforces those values further. Finally, major historical events leave permanent marks on political culture. These are not just individual memories, but collective experiences that reshape how entire generations think about politics. The Great Depression of the 1930s, which was a period of catastrophic economic collapse that left millions unemployed and destitute, fundamentally changed American political culture. People who lived through it came to believe that government must play a strong role in protecting citizens from economic disaster, a belief that shaped American politics for decades. In contrast, the Watergate scandal of the 1970s, which was a major political scandal involving the criminal activities of President Nixon's government, shattered trust in the presidency and created a deep cynicism about political leadership that is still measurable in American surveys today. Events do not just pass. They leave sediment in the culture. Let us now bring all of this to life through three detailed case studies. Each one shows how political culture is not an abstract concept but a living, breathing reality that explains things we might otherwise find puzzling. Consider the United States. At the core of American political culture sits a powerful and enduring value, individual freedom. Americans broadly believe that the most important political right is the freedom of the individual to make their own choices without interference from government. This is not just an idea. It is felt deeply and emotionally. It shapes everything. It explains why the United States has uniquely strong protections for free speech, even speech that many people find hateful or offensive. The belief is that the government must never decide what people are allowed to say. It explains the fierce defense of gun ownership, which many Americans see not just as a leisure activity but as a fundamental check on government tyranny. If the citizens are armed, the thinking goes, the government cannot enslave them. It explains the historical resistance to a large welfare state, meaning a comprehensive system of government support for health, housing, and income. Even when poverty and inequality are severe, many Americans feel uncomfortable with the government taking money from one person to give to another. This is not cruelty. It is a deeply held value about fairness, individual responsibility, and the proper limits of government power. Where did these values come from? They came from history. The American nation was born in a revolution against a distant, unresponsive monarchy. The founding documents, most famously the Declaration of Independence, placed individual liberty at the very heart of the national project. The experience of the frontier, where ordinary people had to rely entirely on themselves and their neighbors to survive, reinforced values of self-reliance and skepticism of distant authority. Enlightenment philosophy, which was an intellectual movement that emphasized reason, individual rights, and the limits of power, provided the intellectual framework. These historical roots created a political culture that is now centuries old and deeply entrenched, and it shapes every political debate Americans have, from healthcare to guns to immigration. Now travel across the world to Japan. Japanese political culture is built around a very different set of values. The single most important value is harmony, known in Japanese as wa. In Japanese culture, open conflict is generally considered harmful and embarrassing. Decisions should be reached through careful, quiet negotiation, through consultation and consensus building, meaning the process of reaching a decision that everyone can accept rather than through winner-takes-all confrontation. This is not weakness. It is a different and deeply held understanding of how human beings should relate to each other and how decisions should be made. These values have roots that go back centuries. Confucianism, which is a philosophical tradition originating in China that spread throughout East Asia, placed enormous weight on hierarchy, deference to elders and superiors, and the priority of group harmony over individual self-expression. Japan's long feudal history, where society was organized into rigid layers with strict obligations at each level, reinforced these values of duty, loyalty, and deference. When Japan modernized rapidly in the late 19th and 20th centuries, these deep cultural values were not swept away. They were absorbed into the new political system. The result is a political style that looks very different from Western democracies. Even though Japan is genuinely democratic, political deals are often worked out in private meetings among senior leaders before they ever reach a public stage. Confrontational debate in parliament can seem performative rather than genuinely decisive because the real decisions happened earlier, quietly. For most of the post-war period, a single political party, the Liberal Democratic Party, dominated Japanese politics almost without interruption. This was not simply the result of rigged elections. It was partly a reflection of a political culture that valued stability and trusted the established order to manage affairs. If things were functioning reasonably well, why disrupt them? This cultural preference for stability over change is a subject-participant blend that Almond and Verba's framework helps us understand. Now let us move to Russia. Russian political culture is one of the most discussed and debated in the world, and understanding it is essential to understanding some of the most consequential political events of the 21st century. At its core, Russian political culture contains a powerful desire for a strong leader who can guarantee order and national pride, combined with deep cynicism about ordinary politics and low expectations of civic participation making any difference. These orientations were not chosen by Russians. They were produced by history. For centuries, Russia was ruled by tsars, which is what Russian emperors were called, who held essentially absolute power. There was no tradition of parliamentary government, no culture of citizens challenging authority through legal or electoral means. Then came the Soviet period, which lasted from 1917 to 1991. nearly three-quarters of a century of communist totalitarianism. Totalitarianism means a system where the state attempts to control every aspect of life, including what people say, what they read, and even what they believe. Under such a system, civic engagement is not just discouraging but actively dangerous. The rational response is to keep your head down, say what is expected, and survive. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Russia attempted a rapid transition to democratic capitalism. This transition was deeply painful. The economy collapsed. Ordinary savings evaporated. Organized crime became extraordinarily powerful. Life expectancy fell. The chaos of the 1990s burned itself into Russian political memory as a warning. Democracy and freedom, as Russia experienced them, meant poverty, disorder, and humiliation. When Vladimir Putin rose to power in 2000 and began concentrating authority, cracking down on opposition, and projecting strength domestically and internationally, many Russians genuinely supported this. Not because they were deceived, but because stability and national pride had become more valuable to them than the abstract principles of liberal democracy, which they associated with disaster. This is the civic culture in action, or rather, the absence of it, replaced by a deep subject culture that prioritizes order over accountability. This does not mean that all Russians think the same way, or that Russian political culture cannot change. It means that the weight of history has created a powerful set of orientations that any political reformer must contend with. Young, urban, educated Russians have shown different values in periodic waves of protest. Political culture is not destiny, but it is gravity. This brings us to the criticisms of the concept. Every powerful idea in social science has its flaws, and political culture is no exception. Scholars have raised three important challenges. The first is the problem of determinism. Determinism means the idea that outcomes are fixed and predetermined by prior causes, leaving no room for human choice or change. Critics worry that talking about political culture suggests that countries are trapped by their histories. If Russia's political culture makes authoritarianism inevitable, or if some developing countries' political cultures make democracy impossible, then we are saying these outcomes cannot change. This is both politically dangerous and factually wrong. Political culture changes, sometimes slowly, sometimes with surprising speed when major events or strong leaders force new norms into existence. The relationship between culture and politics runs in both directions. Culture shapes political institutions, but political institutions also shape culture over time. The second challenge is the monolithic fallacy. Monolithic means single and unified, like a single giant stone. The criticism is this: can any large, diverse, modern nation really have one political culture? The United States contains urban, secular, highly educated professionals and rural, religious, working-class farmers. Are they really part of the same political culture? Scholars respond to this by introducing the idea of political subcultures. A subculture is a distinct cultural pattern within a larger culture. The United States has a dominant national political culture built on individual liberty and democratic norms, but it also contains powerful regional subcultures. The South, with its distinct history of racial hierarchy and religious conservatism. The Northeast, with its traditions of elite governance and civic activism. The West, with its frontier-inflected libertarianism. Understanding politics often requires understanding which subculture is speaking and when. The third challenge is the measurement problem. How do you actually measure something as invisible as values and norms?
You cannot put a society's political culture under a microscope. Surveys are the main tool, and large international projects like the World Values Survey, which surveys hundreds of thousands of people across dozens of countries, have produced invaluable data.
But surveys have limits. People sometimes give the answer they think sounds right rather than the answer that reflects how they truly feel or behave. Questions may not translate perfectly across languages and cultures. And the deepest political norms are often precisely the ones people never consciously think about, which makes them very hard to ask about. This does not mean political culture cannot be studied scientifically. It means we must be humble about the precision of our conclusions. There is one final dimension worth exploring.
and it is perhaps the most practically important one for our time. Political culture does not only explain how democracies function, it explains how they survive or fail. A democracy is much more than a set of laws. It is a set of shared commitments that have to be renewed by each generation. When enough citizens no longer believe that elections are legitimate, when enough leaders no longer feel bound by norms of restraint, when the unwritten rules that hold the system together erode, democracy becomes fragile. This is why political scientists who study democratic decline, meaning the process by which democracies gradually become less democratic, pay so much attention to cultural shifts. The formal institutions may still be standing, the parliament, the courts, the free press, but if the cultural foundations beneath them are crumbling, the formal structures cannot survive indefinitely. This is also why education and the free and honest transmission of political knowledge across generations matters so much more than it is usually given credit for. It is not glamorous. It does not produce the dramatic headlines of elections or coups or revolutions, but it is the quiet, slow work of maintaining the cultural foundations on which democratic life depends. Every time a teacher explains honestly how power works, every time a parent models civic engagement for their child, every time a community institution upholds the norms of fair dealing and honest debate, the civic culture is being rebuilt, brick by invisible brick. Let us bring all of this together in a brief summary of what we have covered today. Political culture is the shared system of beliefs, values, and norms through which a society understands and practices politics. It was given its modern scientific form by Gabriel Almond and Sidney Verba, who identified three components: cognitive beliefs about how politics works, effective values about what matters in political life, and evaluative norms about what constitutes acceptable political behavior. They described three broad types of political culture: paroquial, where citizens are unaware of national politics; subject, where citizens are aware but passive; and participant, where citizens are active and engaged. The healthiest culture for democracy is the civic culture, a balance of all three. Political culture is formed through socialization, meaning it is learned through family, schools, media, peer groups, and formative historical events. The examples of the United States, Japan, and Russia show how deeply historical roots can shape contemporary political realities in vastly different ways. The concept is not without critics, who warn against determinism, against ignoring internal diversity, and against overconfidence in our ability to measure something so subtle. But used carefully, political culture remains one of the most powerful tools we have for understanding why politics works the way it does, and why the same formal rules can produce such different results in different places and times.